is an especially good way to kick off an academic year. I was telling Ursula on the way up here that I recently was shown a list of international speakers to be invited to a conference on the 150th anniversary of Marx's Capital, the first volume of which was published in 1867. And it listed, you know, the usual famous Marxist suspects, David Harvey and Emanuel Wallerstein and so on. And there wasn't a single woman on the list of about, I think, 16 people. And then, you know, I thought, you know, this isn't a very good show. But then I thought to myself, well, who could I think of to suggest to them that would be properly there? First came to mind Mary Gabriel, who, if you haven't read her book, she's a journalist and a novelist. And she's written a marvelous history of Jenny Marx called Love and Capital. The greatest reads you'll ever have. It's hard to put down. And then the second person that I immediately thought of was Ursula Hughes, who is, I think, the most creative, the most productive Marxist feminist economist alive, engaging with the transformations that capitalism is bringing about in our world in a way that is not simply borrowing Marxist ideas, but is developing them, is making them relevant to understanding this incredible technological revolution that has so transformed our lives. Certainly those of us who existed before it are very, very aware of the enormous transformations that this has brought about. And Ursula, more than anyone, male or female, in any part of the world, has been not only extremely on top of and aware of these technological transformations, but she has provided a depth of understanding of them and their relationship, above all, to labor processes that no one else matches. As you see, she's now at the University of Hertfordshire, but for decades she operated as an independent scholar. And as such, founded a journal that virtually no one does without university support, an international journal called Work Organization, Labor, and Globalization, which is the leading site in the world for creative new work, understanding the relationship between labor and the new technology. And Ursula's central theme I was very proud in the Register to publish our first real good piece on this by Ursula called Material World, almost 20 years ago. Her central theme is that these notions of the weightless economy, the knowledge economy, et cetera, the cyber world, are thrown around without much understanding, as you'll hear today, of their grounding in human labor. In one marvelous piece that she wrote, she simply sat in her room and said, as I look around, working on the computer, in cyberspace presumably, at all the material things that surround me to make this knowledge economy, this cyber economy function. It's one of the greatest paragraphs of writing I can remember. So it's marvelous that Ursula, who has been here before and talked about people working in call centers, talked about the logistics of people engaged in the transportation and value chain networks that allow these genes that were produced by Chinese workers in China to be sold at a Walmart, thinking about all of the networks of labor that go into making our transnational global economy function. Ursula has done this more than anyone. And today, in addressing the gig economy, I think we're in for another treat in this respect. Ursula.
goodness, can you hear me if I stay sitting there? Well, thank you so much, Leo, as always, totally generous. And I think after an introduction like that, I'm afraid I can only let you down. Who could live up to that? But anyway, I'll try. Thank you so much for inviting me to Mark and to the Centre. I'm going to talk today, I think it's necessary to start, and I hope you won't feel patronised by this. I think there are some misunderstandings around right now, actually about what capitalism is. The way a lot of young people talk about capitalism suggests to me that they haven't quite got their heads around how it works. And this is absolutely understandable because it's so pervasive. It's in every aspect of our lives and it feels so joined up. The experience of consuming, the experience of working, the experience of talking to your friends on social media, it's all part of this great big joined up thing. So it's quite difficult to see that as a lot of little bits and pieces that fit together like a jigsaw. But I think we have to start by making it clear that although capitalism, at one abstract level, it is a single homogenous system, in its material reality, it's actually a lot of competing capitalists, competing with each other, some winning and some losing. So the landscape is you know, how capitalism works is through competition, but through a very often very ruthless and destructive kind of competitions. And one has to bear that in mind, that there are individual capitalists who employ people and who sell stuff to people. It's not just, you're not just working for the big cloud, you're working for a specific capitalist when you're doing a particular piece of work. As capitalism grows, the gap between the creation of value and the realization of that value gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It gets bigger and bigger because capitalism itself is much bigger and much more complicated. Because things are spread out over a much bigger space around the globe. So, and it's in that gap between value creation and value realization that capitalists take their risk. Imagine you've got a guy, he's got, he's paid for a company like Foxconn in China to assemble a mobile phone, and, you know, paid for all the raw materials to be brought to Foxconn, and then they've been put into a shipping container by another group of workers, and that shipping container is sitting halfway across the Pacific. If by the time that shipping container disembarks in Oakland or wherever, and the stuff goes to an Amazon warehouse, and the Amazon warehouse workers have sorted it out and delivered it to somebody's home, and some poor just-in-time delivery guy has finally got it to your front door. If that doesn't happen quickly enough, those phones may never be sold. A competitor may bring out a cheaper or a better model, it may be out of date, all sorts of things can go wrong. Or it could be shoes, it could be blue jeans or whatever. If that value is not realised, then that capitalist has lost money. So it's really important to be aware of that whole chain is there, and that whole chain doesn't just involve the logistics workers, but it also involves a whole lot of people like in call centres, processing the claims, and it also increasingly involves people as consumers, doing a lot of the labour of like specifying what they want to buy, and if the companies are really clever, they get you to pay in advance for them. So there's an enormous network of people involved in the gap between the value creation and the value realisation. And so that's why there's such a huge pressure on logistics workers, on like warehouse workers, transport workers, those poor guys who work on the international container ships, the guys in the warehouse, you know, the pressure. Every second counts in terms of getting things really quickly to market. So that is part of the context of contemporary capitalism that you really have to be aware of. And this factor of speed, of course, doesn't just apply to the physical movement of physical goods, but also to the virtual movement of data and information and online. Websites have to load quickly or people won't use them, that sort of stuff. So Another thing that I think a lot of people are not aware of is they have an idea of capitalism as producing surplus value, right? You know, commodity production, producing surplus value. Red marks about, you know, the worker who works so many hours a day for their own subsistence, and then the surplus is taken by the employer and becomes the profit. And this is the central model of how capitalism works, that conflictual relationship between the capitalist and the worker about, you know, how much of that worker's productive time can be grabbed for capital as surplus value. That is certainly remains as the basic and the central, if you like, business model of capitalism. But that doesn't mean that all capitalists make their profits from commodity production. And it doesn't mean that all workers are necessarily producing surplus value, because different capitalists have different business models. There is rent, which is important, you know, all kinds of rent, like the kind of rent that banks take in interest payments, the kind of rent that is taken by physical landlords, and all sorts of commissions that are taken, which I'll go on to talk about, because a lot of the platform economy models are to do with basically taking rent on transactions between people. So there are capitalist organisations that are basically based on making rent, or combining making rent with other kinds of value production. There is also trade. It's a very old way of making money that predates capitalism, buying something at one price, selling it at another price, making a profit, or indeed stealing it and selling it and making a profit. But these things still go on. They're still all out there. And then, of course, there is commodity production, which I was talking about earlier. But the capitalist system that we live in consists in an extremely complex interaction among capitalists who are parasitic, collusive, kleptocratic, competitive. There are these are sometimes very antagonistic, but sometimes collusive when it comes to the class interests being at stake. But the relationships between different capitalists can't be just read off. You have to actually analyse which company has which strategy in which situation, if you want to actually understand what's going on in capitalism and what the broad dynamics of capitalist development are at any given moment in time. So this is part of the context. So a little bit more before I get to the point. First, of course, we all know about the tendency of the rate of profits to decline. I guess I don't need to explain that to people here, that there is a general tendency as competitors come to speak. You know, you've got one capitalist who's got a business model making whatever it is, tables, you know, and then along comes another company that's able to make tables too, and perhaps a little bit cheaper. So there's more and more of a competitive squeeze on profits as companies have to compete more and more with each other. And then you start running out of markets, and people who try and get around that by investing in a lot of machinery have to work the labour much harder because they have to buy the machinery at the market price, etc. There is a general tendency of the rate of profit to decline. Trust me on this, I don't want to explain volumes of capital here. But what that does is it leads to recurrent crises, right? And the most recent of which was 2007-2008, but it's not the only one, certainly not been the only one in my lifetime. And the crises happen, and individual capitalists recover or not, a lot of them go under in any given crisis, but how individual capitalists tend to recover from crises is, one way is by cannibalising other companies. You get a huge wave of mergers and acquisitions and concentrations of capital that enable some to survive, by increasing the rate of exploitation of labour, which of course is easy to do after a crisis, because after a crisis you're going to have really high unemployment, so it's much easier to strike hard bargains with labour. But that can be done by several means. It can be done by automation, which de-skills the workers and means fewer workers produce more. It can be done by lengthening the working day, or it can be done by substituting cheap labour from the reserve army for organised and more expensive labour. And that reserve army in these days of globalisation, when Marx was writing about the reserve army, Marx and Engels, they tended to think of the reserve army as being in a sort of bounded geographical space in the country or even the city in which the production was happening. So in the reserve army for Manchester, you know, in the 1830s would be like the surrounding countryside. But we now have a global reserve army that can be accessed in two quite distinct ways. It can be accessed by bringing in migrant workers, and if they're undocumented, so much the better, because then they have no ability to assert their rights. Or it can be done by shifting the work to the developing parts of the world. So there are two alternative ways of accessing that global reserve army. Or it can be done by externalising paid labour to consumers, by getting consumers to do some of the work that was previously done by paid workers. What that does is it increases the productivity of the paid workers. So the more you can be persuaded to book your airline tickets online, you know, the more the airline company is able to exploit the labour of their actual employees. So that's part of, that's one capitalist strategy, is just to simply increase the rate of exploitation of labour. But there are other things that capitalism needs to do, because this capitalism has to keep growing. The dynamic of capitalism is it has to keep growing. Rosa Luxemburg writes beautifully about this. And so as well as increasing the rate of exploitation of the existing labour force, it has to find new things to commodify, new forms of commodity production. Some of that is what is sometimes called primitive accumulation. David Harvey calls it accumulation by dispossession. He means more or less the same thing by that, which always strikes me as a little bit of a kind of tautology, because it's just like saying property is theft, really, isn't it? But anyway, it's basically going out and grabbing stuff that's in nature and enclosing it and appropriating, whether that's the DNA of plants or the deep ocean where you can start farming fish or whatever it is. It can be done by recommodifying the social commons, by privatising public services or common land or other common properties, and turning into commodities something which has been, so to speak, decommodified in the past, which is already out there in the money in the social division of labour, but is not at the moment inside the capitalist system. Or it can be done by the commodification of art, culture. Commodification of art and culture is very important right now. The bringing within the scope of multinational companies of a lot of creative activities that used to be carried out outside the capitalist economy. And the body, things like plastic surgery or drugs or whatever, and reproductive, all sorts of aspects of reproductive labour, which I will come on to, are being sucked into the nexus of capitalist relations. And then there's something else that happens, which is a general historical tendency, which is the transformation of services to goods. Once service industries reach a certain kind of saturation point, it's very difficult to increase the rate of profit, because if services are being delivered one-to-one by a person to a client, whether it's like a hairdresser or a washer person or something like that, there's a kind of limit to how much profit can be made. But by developing a new machine that can do that work, it ratchets everything up and moves it onto a new scale, like substituting the washing machine for the laundry worker is an example of that. This is relevant, you'll understand later why I make this point now. So we've got all these tendencies going on, Now, in the current context, there's a very familiar story here. What happens is you get a financial crisis, whether you're talking about the one that happened in 1973 or the one that happened in the early 90s or the one that happened in 2007-2008. There's a crisis of probability, there's a financial crisis, and that leads to job losses, austerity, corporate restructuring, including bankruptcies, mergers and acquisitions, and etc., and an emergence of new winners. And incidentally, a whole discourse about how the mass unemployment and the automation together are going to lead to the situation where robots are going to take all the jobs and capitalism is going to fall to its knees and all that stuff. And part of that restructuring process is an introduction of new technologies. And right now, it seems to me in this period since 2007-2008, getting on for a decade now since that crisis, if you think about it, the technologies abused for labour-displacing forms of automation, robots, drones, 3D printers. There are a lot of technologies out there right now that are reaching critical mass that are labour-displacing. There are continuing commodification of sociality and personal relationships, all that stuff linked to social media. You know, Facebook and Twitter was Twitter around in 2007-2008? It was barely around. But the enormous growth of social media has been part of what's been going on, creating a lot of new opportunities for rent as well as other things. And online platforms for managing labour, which is what I'm mainly going to be talking about today. Some of these have their roots in earlier period, for instance. If you think of online platforms for managing labour, they fall into two very crude categories, really. One is the online management of online work, which is work that can be done anywhere. So if you work for a platform like Upwork or Amazon Mechanical Turk or ClickWorker or whatever, you are actually directly competing with workers in other parts of the world, because you're sitting at home working on your computer or sitting in a cafe working on your computer or whatever. And then the other kind of platform, and that's a broad category, it includes some very high skill stuff, it includes some very low skill click work where you're just paid for clicking like on a website or something like that. But the other kind is the online management of offline work. The online management of work, which either is mobile, like driving or delivery work, you know, Uber or Deliveroo or whatever, or the online management of work that's carried out outside your own home on other people's premises, like TaskRabbit. I think HomeJoy has gone bust, hasn't it? Helpfully. You get different platforms in different countries here, but I guess you're all familiar with these platforms, providing cleaning services, household maintenance, assembling flat furniture, tree surgery, gardening, building work, but also increasingly social care and babysitting and stuff like that as well. But I think it's useful to distinguish between those two broad categories, because the offline work is done in local labour markets, unlike the online work, which is done in global labour markets. So the online work started actually a bit before the financial crisis. A lot of the big platforms, Elance was founded in 1999, Odesk in 2003, they've now merged to form Upwork. And you could see that as an extension of general global sourcing practices that grew up in the 1990s, and also of patterns of freelance work. There have always been a lot of freelance workers in creative industries, and their traditional means of finding work started eroding in the 90s, so they were kind of pushed online. So is in a way that's been an evolutionary process. But the offline platforms overwhelmingly started after the financial crisis. TaskRabbit was 2008, Uber was 2009. That period gave birth to an awful lot of these platforms. So What are the business strategies of online platforms? How do they fit into that larger picture of how capitalism goes on being capitalism, if you like? There isn't a single model. I think it's important to be aware there isn't a single model, and also that the models change dynamically. They don't stand still. The first strategy, which is very visible and obvious, which allowed companies to expand incredibly fast, was to avoid investing in depreciating assets. You know, if you want a chain of hotels, you have to invest in the bricks and mortar. If you want a traditional taxi firm, you invest in the taxis. The Airbnb and Uber and Lyft models were persuading workers to invest in these things. You know, paying the mortgage on the house, paying the whatever, you know, whatever means they use to buy the car, usually it's some kind of hire purchase agreement. Paying for the running costs, paying for the maintenance, carrying the cost of depreciation, carrying the cost of repairs, and just taking a rent, taking a percentage of each transaction. And of course, this enabled them to expand enormously quickly because there's no need for capital investment. The only investment is in the platform, and a little bit of investment in security systems for safe handling of financial transactions across borders and stuff like that. But that could all be outsourced to, you know, PayPal or whatever. But you know, the big companies tend to have their own platforms. So that's one model, taking a rent. Another was to just intervene in trade that's going on. People have always sold. I mean, it's not new to sell your secondhand stuff. It's not new to sell make crafts and sell them. What's new is for there to be huge online marketplaces like eBay and Etsy and Amazon, where you sell your secondhand books or whatever. Again, it's a rent model. You know, create the marketplace, create a critical mass, create the sense that this is the obvious place to go because that's where you'll find the most customers. If you're a seller or if you're a buyer, that's where you'll get the best choice of products. And just sit back and take the rent. Then there is the model of intervening in corporate access to an atomized global workforce. This is what I was talking about earlier when you're seeing the evolution of global sourcing. In the early 90s, you had a pattern of offshore outsourcing. Big companies would set up a subsidiary company or outsource to a subsidiary company, say in India, to get their IT developed. And it was basically a buyer in one location, supplier in another. They might have two or three suppliers. But it was basically quite a simple relationship. In the next stage, the companies that were doing the outsourcing, supplying the outsourced services, like Tata and Infosys and Accenture and Siemens Business Services and so on, they got so big, they started supplying standard products to their corporate clients. So instead of it being the corporate client to, like, going to an old-fashioned tailor saying, you know, give me the bespoke suit, it became much more like the corporate client going to a supermarket and selecting from the standard range of services that were on offer. So the sort of market balance tipped. And then these supplying companies got bigger and bigger. So they then introduced internal global sourcing strategies. So let's say I'm York University that decides to buy a service from Accenture, let's say. It's no longer relevant for me as York University where that service is provided. I just go to Accenture. And Accenture will have one front person in Toronto who deals with York University. And then some of that work will be done in India, some of it will be done in Ireland, some of it will be done. So they have like an internal global sourcing practice. And what these online platforms do is they make that available to people. Well, partly to these very big clients, because they can get it cheaper that way, but mainly to clients who are too small to be able to leverage those big deals like big companies make. It means much, much smaller companies can get their website designed in India than would have been possible 15 years ago. So what these platforms have done, they've intervened in those value chains, saying, look here, I can manage your sourcing for you effectively. Again, take a rent. So that's effectively a rent model. But it's taking a rent from something which is produced, which is part of commodity production, is part of the process of producing commodities. Another strategy, which is evolving really fast, is what I would call a formalisation of the informal economy. There have been all around the world, even in the most developed countries, up until very recently, quite a high proportion of the workforce is involved in delivering private services, whether it's cleaning people's homes, babysitting, doing the gardening, or whatever. There is a large informal economy. And up until quite recently, those people found work through word of mouth, or through putting an ad in the newsagent's window, or local phone books, yellow pages, or leaflets through letterboxes. And now those things are gone, because if I move to a new city and I want a cleaner, what do? I Google the zip code and cleaner. And I might get what I think is a local cleaner. But in fact, what the companies, online companies do is they tag every single postcode there is. And they tag every single kind of service that anybody might possibly want. So if I go cleaner, such and such a postcode, I'd have to go down to like the sixth page of the Google search to find somebody who genuinely was a local cleaner, because all the ones that come up top in the Google search will be global online companies that have just cleverly used the tagging process. And so that cleaners increasingly find they can't find work the other way, so they're obliged, they're pushed into the work for these platforms. And it's quite ambiguous, because if you're like, with part of London where I live, if you were like a traditional plumber in that part of London, with a clientele that you've built up through word of mouth, going to work for one of these companies is like a massive loss of autonomy and a de-skilling. It's really bad. And it's also very negative in terms of your relationship with the client. But if you're a newly arrived migrant who wouldn't know how to get into that labour market, it's a fantastic opportunity, you know. And the same with the clients. If you're somebody like me who's lived in England all my life and knows how to deal with the strange guy who comes to fix the tap in the bathroom, that's fine. But if I was a newly arrived immigrant or a young person, I might be quite scared of inviting a strange guy to my... You know, the platforms give a sense of safety in a way. It's like when people are travelling and they say, I want a cup of coffee. Oh, I don't speak the language. I don't understand the sign. Oh, there's a Starbucks, you know. They feel safe with it. And I think that's partly how they grow so quickly, these platforms. But the essential model is drag in this informal economy, especially for private services, within the scope of capitalist relations, and take a rent in the early stages. And I'll go on later to talk about the huge impact that has on the kind of quality of working life for these workers. But what's this doing? All right. But of course, it doesn't stop there. Things change very, very dynamically. First of all, we've got a huge concentration of capital. These companies are merging with each other like there's no tomorrow. You've got these, because of network effects, you get these winner-take-all logics. People think, oh, Airbnb is the biggest, it's the one everybody's heard of. I'm most likely to find a bed and breakfast through Airbnb, and the people providing bed and breakfast think, oh, well, I'll get the biggest range of clients for Airbnb. So Airbnb ends up taking over, and if there is a little local firm in wherever, you know, Slovenia, that's competing with Airbnb, they're very well placed to just buy them up. So there's a huge expansion, and in some cases, actual monopolization going on. There's, and as I said earlier, the lack of the need for fixed capital investment has allowed this incredibly rapid expansion across borders. Uber came to Europe in the beginning of 2013 and said they were going to create 50,000 jobs in Europe by the end of the year. They'd created them by March, you know. They're now, I was reading this morning, they've reached getting on for monopoly status in Mexico City, in Sao Paulo, in Mumbai. I mean, the global expansion is just unbelievable. As I said before, the network effects create winner-take-all dynamics. So you've got these huge changes going on in the market. And also, incidentally, you've also got, I suppose it's not surprising because capitalism is capitalism, but people sort of imagine that these platforms are set up by like these, what they call unicorns, you know, these entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley who have the genius idea and become millionaires from scratch. A lot of the investment comes from kind of what you might call old capitalism. Like Wonolo, what now locally, which is one of these, was set up with money from Coca-Cola, for instance. General Motors has a controlling share in, I think it's General Motors, in Avis, which owns Zipcar, which owns, do you know what I mean? This is not, these are not just new capitalists. And also, the other thing that happens, as always happens, is the world reacts. Here's the new phenomenon, which is absolutely changing the landscape. So, organised, I call them crowd workers because I've worked on a project where we call them that. It might not be a good term to use here. Protests, especially taxi drivers, who are traditionally quite well organised. And some crowd workers themselves start to organise. Public authorities start saying, hey, we've got to intervene here. So you get a city like Berlin will negotiate with Uber, or Barcelona negotiates with Airbnb, or whatever it is, and it's happening here in Toronto right now as we speak, I believe. And, you know, the world doesn't just sit back and let this happen. And copycat companies try to undercut. And also, the practices spread across the economy to other sectors. So the competitive advantage becomes less and less. You've got competitors coming in, underpricing them, but you've also got like the traditional companies that used to employ people in quite different ways using these practices. You've got people on 0-hours contracts in like regular service industries, for instance. You've got lots of workers are effectively on call now, even if they've got employee contracts. So anyway, so costs increase, profitability falls. But meanwhile, of course, they've become huge. Huge surpluses have accumulated. And companies have been floated on the stock exchange, and they're becoming more and more like old capitalist organisations. And they evolve into something different. It seems to me highly likely, there's only a little bit of evidence for this, that a lot of companies are going to, because of pressure from workers and from authorities to apply employment legislation and stuff like that. In fact, Homejoy, before it went bust, one of the things that Homejoy did was turn a lot of its workers into employees, because they found that customers, that they were more reliable if they were employees, and also that customers felt more comfortable knowing that they were employees. They didn't want some junkie bringing their groceries into their home when they were out. You know, they felt a bit safer with employees. So I think they're going to turn into what look like service companies, a lot of these companies. Service supply companies, cleaning companies, gardening companies, whatever it is, which is a transition away from the rent model. But the other thing, which I find quite amusing in it's not amusing because, you know, capitalism does such horrible things to people, it's never amusing. But Uber, which started with this business model of, you know, we don't make any investment, the worker makes all the investments in the car, what are they doing? They're using driverless cars. They've pioneered using driverless cars in Pittsburgh. They've reached the stage when they've driven all the other taxi companies out. They've got a near monopoly situation as the dominant taxi service provider in a city like Pittsburgh. Where do they go from there? How do they expand? They increase the rate of exploitation of the workforce by automating. It's just like the old strategy of what they did in the mills 200 years ago, which I found quite interesting. So the platform economy is really increasingly integrated into capitalism as usual. But in the process, things have changed a lot for labour. Have I got time? Am I going over time here? I think I've got another couple of slides. What does this mean for labour? I think it's important to look at this. First of all, large groups of workers, especially from the private services sector, are being brought from the first time within the direct, into the scope of direct capitalist relationships. And this means completely different forms of discipline. It means different kind of time structures. They're very, very tightly managed in terms of time. They have to, the tasks are specified, they're paid per task. If the customer is not happy with the task, they're not paid at all, usually. And customers know that there is no appeal against a bad customer rating. Bad customer rating can really kill a worker in the labour market. But some customers know that the guy actually did a great job, but they just don't want to pay them, so they give him a bad rating. Worker doesn't get paid. Customers got away with wage theft, actually. That's interesting. It's coming in the wrong order. Makes more sense. And right across the economy, across a very large range of different kinds of activities, employers are being given easy access to the reserve army. There used to be all kinds of transaction costs, information barriers, things that made it difficult, especially for small firms, to access migrant workers, especially in small towns. Workers had quite, even if they didn't have formal bargaining power, had quite a degree of informal bargaining power, when the supply of skills is limited, when everybody's known to each other and so on. So these platforms have given a whole new range of employers access to the global reserve army, which of course has dramatic effects on the value of that labour. It pushes enormous downward pressure on wages and on bargaining power. Back to the other point, I think I've talked about this already, externally determined time regimes, which if you're a traditional window cleaner, going around from house to house with your ladder and your bucket and having a cup of tea and chatting and, as you're here, please could you help me cut back the wisteria, which is something I make my window cleaner do. That's kind of relationship with the client, that's gone, with these companies, because they're told they've got 45 minutes for the job, and that's it. Loss of autonomy, standardisation of tasks, expectations to be available 24/7, because if you don't respond to a call, you're very often struck off. It's like zero hours contract work. The contract says, you have to be available if we want you. Although in principle, a lot of platform workers have the right to say no. When you talk to them in practice, they don't dare, because they know there are a lot of other people out there. And the other complicated thing is that because everything's done online, including payment, everything is tracked. What time they turn up to the job, how long it takes them, when they finish, how much they're paid, what the task was, what the customer satisfaction was, etc., etc. And all this data, of course, is collected, and it can then be used to set even very precise, to, to keep fine-tuning the indicators. It's exactly the same for university lecturers, at least in the UK. We have our performance indicators, and the more you fill in the form saying, this is how many 3-star journal articles I wrote last year, and this is how many, then that data is then used to give you even more precise performance indicators next year. And so it's not unique to these platforms, this process, but it's a kind of snowball effect. You know, the more data is collected, the more performance monitoring there is, and the more performance monitoring there is, the more data has to be collected. And the customer ratings, as I said, are used as a disciplinary tool. But more importantly, the existence and the refinements of these practices by online platforms legitimizes their use. It doesn't just develop the techniques and the technologies, but it legitimizes their use by traditional employers. I wrote an article about this recently where I talk about logged labor, where increasingly the new model of labor, if you like, is logged in 3 quite distinct senses. You have to be logged on, because you're always waiting for the next summer. It's logged in the sense of as a tree is logged. It's chopped up into lots of standardized units and tasks. And it's logged in the sense of it's monitored and surveyed and recorded. This is the results of this. Have I got time to show you some quick slides? I've just done a survey. This is some empirical stuff to back this up. This is in 4-5 European countries. The Austrian results I won't go into the details, but the purple one are a little bit the outliers. But if you look at the other countries, it's quite a standard pattern. This is just putting it in the context of people getting an income from online platforms compared with getting an income online by other means. So you've got like between 50 and 60%, let's say, of the population in these countries selling stuff on eBay regularly. Around 30% selling products on online market. So reselling stuff rather than just selling stuff they already own. You've got people selling craft stock, you've got people selling on their own website. You've got around 10%, well, probably between 7 and 10%, except Austria, which is peculiar, using Airbnb to rent out, to make money out of renting out rooms. And then put in context, you've got probably around, most countries, around 12% of the population deriving already, this is a total adult online adult population, deriving some income from crowd work in one capacity or another. But most of them are doing it. A lot of them are looking for it and not getting it. They're registering their details on platform Uber and not getting any customers. Those are the ones at the bottom. But you can see you've got 3 or 4% actually, you know, doing it weekly. Quite a lot doing it at least monthly. And then in terms of the income, for most people it's a supplement, which tells you something about how badly paid they are in their other jobs to some extent. But you've got these people down here where it's actually all their income, and quite a substantial proportion where it's over half. It's quite significant. And I'm not going to give you lots of Austria, I've just picked out a few slides here. This is where we left Austria out, because Austria is a bit peculiar. And this is to show that these practices exist right across the workforce. This is at how many people, so they use an app to notify when work is available. And what we compared is the people who do it at least once a week, the people who do it occasionally, and the people who don't do it. And so the people who do it at least once a week, you see a lot of them are relying on these apps, but not all of them. But look at all these people, you know, 10% of the workforce in Sweden who are not crowd working are, you know, being summoned to work by an app. This is people who have to log their hours on a website or an app. Again, I mean, it's only a minority, but there are a lot of people there who are not working for online platforms, will have you, well, we have to do it. My university, we have to do it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't, but adjunct teaching staff do. They have to use a website to record, you know, every week, put in how many hours teaching they've done, you know, all that stuff. It really spreads very, very fast. So that's just to give you a feel that there is some empirical basis to what I was talking about. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we have some 25 minutes for discussion, questions, and so on. Yes, back.
Yeah, I have a question.